Blog Talk Radio.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم. بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم. الحمد لله رب العالمين. الرحمن الرحيم. مالك يوم الدين. إياك نعبد وإياك نستعين. اهدنا الصراط المستقيم. صراط الذين أنعمت عليهم غير المغضوب عليهم ولا الضالين.
Assalamu alaikum. This is Latifa A. Hamid, the CEO for American Muslim 360, the number one Islamic radio station in the nation, where your intellect is respected and your voice is protected.
The views expressed by the host guests are their own and not necessarily the position of AM 360 or the parent corporation, the Community-Wide Shura Conference, CWSC Incorporated. AM 360 content is intended as a community service and is not designed to provide specific personal, medical, financial, or legal counsel or other professional advice, and no liability shall extend to the host or hostesses of AM 360 or CWSC. We encourage you to seek an advisor for your specific circumstance. Now, Joshua fought the battle of Jericho.
So guys talking about, you know, calling girls bitches, that, you know, she made a comeback song on it. So, you know, that's the basic premise that we're on, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, that we want to, you know, talk about, you know, some, you know, why they say, you know, especially as far as being Muslim and saying that music is haram. And a lot of times we say music is haram because of the negative, you know, language that is actually in hip hop. So I'm going to, that's the presentation. And I'm going to allow, before I let you respond, Cavell, I'm going to open up the microphone for Sister Martha Nyla Williams, the American Muslim 360 representative. Assalamu alaikum. Good morning, Sister Martha.
Alaikum assalam. Alaikum assalam, and good morning to both of you this morning. It's so wonderful to be alive and thankful for this opportunity to connect another level. So I pray that you all are enjoying life to its fullest, inshallah, God willing. And we're here and ready to be connected.
Okay. Okay, very good. Okay, so Cavell, that was – so I would appreciate, you know, you go ahead and give a response as far as my opening presentation.
Well, I will say this. I think that there is clearly, because of the society that we live in and have developed the culture of hip-hop in, that there is definitely a, from the beginning, a look into the relationships between men and women and how that is dealt with in storytelling, right? Because inevitably, you know, Rapper's Delight was a story, you know, that was being told by some MCs who, as a matter of fact, did not actually write any of those lyrics. Those lyrics were really written for them. And so they were taking what someone else's experience was or what someone else had, you know, envisioned in the community and put down on paper. And then they were able to utilize that, which, again, becomes, you know, the first rap record to, you know, really explode onto the scene. But, of course, I think that that has root the expression about women and the relationship between women and men in our communities has a root in all music, music before that time, and just continued directly into the hip-hop genre. And in terms of Drake, Drake is an instigator, someone who is looking to continuously keep his name in the sphere of popular culture. And so by him,
so you're saying that he does that on purpose?
Yes. I think that there are, once again, we must look at these people, and particularly somebody like Drake. Drake is not a rapper from a neighborhood who's like on a block doing something, you know, for social media. Drake is a product, a multi-billion dollar product that record companies put a lot of money into in order to have him seen, recognized, and influencing the messaging, not only the messaging, but influencing cultures and people across the globe. And so they're very clear on what they put into the music, because it's about crossing lines, playing the edge, being someone who is talked about. And I believe that something like this being said is about being talked about more than it's about disrespecting somebody. He understands it's disrespectful, but does it in order for, and his company, his producers, his writers, his team, they're all on board with understanding what kind of response will happen and then how they deal with those responses.
So now, you know, at you know, at the beginning of hip-hop, there wasn't, it wasn't a battle situation, but it seemed to transition into a battle situation with Run DMC when he started saying, and when a sucker MC want to prove a point, when, you know, he started calling MCs suckers, and it just seemed like the music, the way that they actually did it, that they actually took tone out and they just made it all about drums. And, you know, the drum beat, ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta-ta- just a drum track. So that, mm-hmm. you know, and in battle, as far as drum tracks, as far as the drum is concerned, you know, they would use the drum in military wars and military you know, keep the momentum of the soldiers up. And it seemed to me, the way that I was looking at it and the way that I observed it, that you know, they had that's what the battle thing, the whole battle thing about battle rap, about you know, the dancing, the battle dancing, you know, all this battle stuff came up, you know, with hip hop when Run DMC and them came on the scene and took tone out of hip hop totally and just started on that track kind of situation. And it made sense because, you know, like, you know, when you're doing rhymes and when you're being a wordsmith, it's all about the rhythm. And so the drum is the thing that carries the rhythm. So yeah, I mean I could understand it, but it just seemed to make a big change as far as hip hop was concerned.
I want to say that, you know, I appreciate that perspective. We teach in the Quick Hitters Experience, when we talk about the history of hip hop, that battling was always the thrust of hip hop, right? Because even making connection historically to the drum being a tool in which armies would move across lands beating their drums in order to, you know, announce their arrival or to instill fear in their opponents. This hip-hop is based on that principle, right? The gangs in the Bronx during the early 70s that had arisen from the lack of resources, the government pretty much saying they didn't have any use for New York, and particularly the areas where there were people of color, those people of color had to survive, and thus you had a gathering of groups, and that gathering of groups were Puerto Ricans, Jamaicans, right? You might have the people born in the South. You have Mexicans. You have, you know, people who are coming in from, you know, Barbados. And you have these groups that are starting to form, and they're formed basically for protection because younger people are feeling threatened by other people because they have to move through these neighborhoods that are already downtrodden. And there were wars. There were, you know, gangs with, you know, serious issues. You could speak more to the names of those gangs because you know, right, growing up in that era.
Right.
But I'll just say that dealing with Zulu, Zulu Nation comes in with Afrika Bambaataa, and Afrika Bambaataa's reputation as a warrior in New York gave people an opportunity to listen to him. And his understanding, even though we can talk about him in a different space, but just in terms of his contribution to the growth of hip-hop from the growth of hip-hop and our communities from a community that was warring physically with chains, knives, guns, and fists into a community that was told, listen, we're not going to do it like that. We're going to take our parties where we see that people are diverse. They're all gathering together in a diverse way, and we're going to expand on that diversity and challenge each other in a more constructive way, and that's the five components, right? The DJs would battle to see who's the better DJ. You can see examples of that in hip-hop history when you look at Grandmaster Flash. And you look at a DJ like Kool Herc, and you look at a DJ like, because Bambaataa was a DJ, and an African Bambaataa as a DJ. And these people were battling. They were battling to see who was the better DJ. And the same thing happened with the MCs. I mean, you can look at Cold Crush Brothers prior to Run DMC, right? Cold Crush Brothers, the Treacherous Three, the Funky Four Plus One. You can look at all of those groups, and see, they were also battling. There's even a famous joint, man, that I love seeing. It's a video of MCs stepping to each other in the Bronx in the early, it looks like the late 70s, early 80s, and they're like stepping up, like, I'm Mike G, yeah, and I'm the one who's the dope. You know what I be doing to you? You can never come. And I'm Sue, hey, that's right. You know I'm the best, and nobody over there will ever test. And Mike G, that, like, there's always been that competitive nature in the culture. Moving forward, though, in terms of today and what you're
talking
about.
Would we also say, would we also say that you know, it's just the competitive nature of actually being a performer and wanting to outperform somebody else's as far as being a performance?
There's no question. I mean, when we compete, right, as human beings, has nothing to do with anything outside of the desire to be better than the other human being, right? So, yeah, I think that there's clearly been that ever since the beginning.
Yeah.
But as I was saying, moving forward, Curtis Blow. Sorry.
Yeah.
I didn't mean to cut you off.
Yeah, what was his, you know, because he seemed to have been an influence. Because I think there was this place in the Bronx that, you know, people used to go and, you know, and that was also another thing that, you know, the club that, you know, or the, yeah, yes, Skate and others,
uh-huh.
You know, where people would go, yeah, where people would go to, you know, well, I guess and it would be, the artists would be there every week. To, you know, go ahead and, you know, but, you know, what was his contribution like?
Well, Curtis Blow obviously is an individual who got the first contract with a record company. So Curtis Blow, that's his contribution. His contribution is he's the one who got the first contract and was able to become an ambassador for the culture in the beginning, in the early 80s. We can talk to basketball. Basketball was one of the best ones, which still plays today. Like played on all kinds of in movies, especially dealing with basketball, movies, commercials, television shows. As a matter of fact, I play a video game. It's called 2K, NBA 2K. And on the game, they have put the song Basketball many times because it resonates with people, right? Even though it was made in the 1980s, early 1980s, just the energy of it. Right. And that was what Curtis Blow did. Curtis Blow had an energy. He had a style. He was presentable, right? You know, he had the curly fro. He had the looks. He was a nice-looking guy. He had the clothes. Yeah. He had the support. A big thing was he had the support, right? He had the support of people from his neighborhood. He had the support of not only people. Another big factor that winds up coming in is criminality, right? A part of music, and particularly in any genre of music, there is an underbelly sometimes that comes from people who get illegal money. And even Curtis Blow's name, Curtis Blow, in the 80s, right, there was a big thing about these names, right? And so Blow was what
right.
people
and right.
Well, that cocaine was called Blow. And so he took
That's
something
right.
that referred to the street, put it in his name, and thus he was able to connect with the streets. But he wasn't a street rapper rapping about street things. He was a party rapper. And that has been talked about many times as well, that the early stages of hip-hop, and particularly the MCs, the music that was created, did not have a criminal element in the music. The music was about fun and having a good time. But in the underbelly of it, going to the Skate Key, going to the Fever, going to some of the places that it was going to be performed or you were going to see it, you would definitely be in those environments with regular people and then people who were in the underbelly of the culture in terms of criminality.
Yeah.
So, you know, yeah. there's always been this connection with the two things. So there is this rebellious kind of, you know, like out-of-pocket spirit that goes along with hip-hop and definitely affected it as you moved into the 80s, especially the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah, I just want to comment on, our contribution, our early contribution, talking about me, you, Bill, and how we got into it. Because when Sugar Hill Gang first came out with it, you know, that was something that I was already doing. I was already taking
mm-hmm.
poetry and putting it to music.
Mm-hmm.
You know, using songs like Donny Hathaway's The Ghetto and putting
mm-hmm.
street lyrics now with Cool and Breezy on this special day when IKB was around my woman's way. We was in the hallway keeping off the coolness of the wind when these three creeps came tipping on in. But it was street. It was a story about the streets. And, you know, I was able to tell that also. We would go to clubs, especially talking about Sugar Hill, the Sugar Hill Shop. They would give events, and one of the famous DJs at that time was DJ Hollywood. And many times
mm-hmm.
DJ Hollywood would be the DJ at these events that was thrown by the Sugar Hill Sports Shop, and they gave me a platform. And this is where I'm going to do Dearest Love. It was a love story, you know, that I made up about, you know, my first wife, Brenda. And, you know, and it was maybe about
who, by the way, is my mom.
Huh? Yeah, that's right.
I said, who, by the way, is my mom.
My first wife. That's right. Yeah, we hung out the other day. It was really great, you know, to be with her. But, you know, we went to see the Michael Jackson concert, as a matter of fact. Thank you, Val. Thank you again for those tickets, man. I really appreciated that. It was good. But not to digress to this point, yeah. The point that I want to make is that, you know, when we would play these clubs like Shea Danielle, Copacabana, the Boat Binghamton, when we would play these places, because this is, you know, because what they would do, Sugar Hill Sports Shop would get these places and people would get dressed up, man, in their finest, man, and come and, you know, just dance and hang out, you know, and just be with each other. And it was real nice.
Right.
And one of the DJs, another one of the DJs that was there was Love Bug Starsky.
R.I.P. to Starsky too, man. You know, he passed away a few years ago. So you know what I'm saying?
Yeah,
rest in peace, Love Bug, man.
But he was interesting because not only was he a DJ, but he was a rapper at the same time, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And he had that sound. It was like that. When they would give these events. Yeah, when they would give these events, it would just give me an opportunity to go ahead and perform. And then when I got with the propagators, it was just an automatic thing, just, you know, applying the knowledge that we were getting from Imam W.D. Muhammad. You know, it was just a thing about, you know, just applying that knowledge. And we just, you know, instead of, you know, talking about Dearest Love or talking about the streets, we were talking about things that was going on in creation. That's where Birds of a Feather came from. And I remember you doing, you would get up and do a poem that was, somebody said that it couldn't be done, but he with a chuckle replied. And the people loved it.
I stole joints, man. I mean, and that's where I gained the love for hip-hop. You know, what I did was, it wasn't so much that there was something happening in the streets. The reality of my own existence in the culture of hip-hop comes from the fact my father, you know what I'm saying, Brother Kareem, Pop was the one who brought me onto a stage, gave me some words to say, and thus I was able to see a reaction. That reaction, that energy that was given by the American Muslims, the Black American Muslims who we were around, it gave me a feeling that was like none ever, and that sparked my interest in the art form, particularly the art form of rhyming, and that started making me listen to the different MCs that were out there as things started to evolve. And of course, Rapper's Delight comes out. But before Rapper's Delight comes out, which I think was 79, either 78 or 79.
Yeah, something like that, 78,
right.
79.
When it comes out, I'm already 6 or 7 years old and have already been with my father at shows performing. This didn't happen because Rapper's Delight came out. Rapper's Delight coming out, as a matter of fact, because it was on Sugar Hill Records, right? I definitely thought there was a connection between my father, Sugar Hill Sports Shop, the Sugar Hill idea, period, and this record, right? So for me, I feel like I've always been connected to hip-hop in a different way because it's from my neighborhood. It's from the block. It's from the experiences that I had, not only as it became a genre to listen to, but prior to it, because we lived here, we were at shows, we listened to you as an MC rhyme already. It was clear that we were going to enjoy this new genre and contribute it and continue to support it as we, you know, move into the future.
You know, the other, you know, just to give some history. Continued history as far as the community, Imam W.D. Muhammad. You know, when you know, it's I have to say that the shout out to Imam Ali Rashid, may Allah forgive him his sins and favor him with a comfortable space in the paradise, for the efforts and work that he did, you know, while he was here with us at Masjid Malcolm Shabazz. But, you know, he was a big supporter of the propagators, and he actually gave us space in the masjid, down in the basement. We would meet every week, and we were able to make up songs. And then right across the street, there was a school. And then he would, you know, we would, you know, because he had some political connections, too, with the community. So he was able to go there right there on 117th Street. You remember on 117th Street, Cabell?
I know your mother does. Come on. I already know I used to sit there with
your mother would come over there and harass me. But about you being on the stage and, you know, when is my son going up? Anyway, but we started, you know, traveling around the community, you know, as the propagators. And what was unique, especially as far as hip-hop, you know, the propagators were doing a cappella music. And so when we would do the hip-hop song, Birds of a Feather Flock Together, when we would do that song, it was like hip-hop was just coming out and, you know, there was a Muslim that was already involved in it. And it took the community by surprise, but they really appreciated and supported, you know, the fact that, you know, like the Muslims was actually, you know, right there on the curves of doing hip hop, you know, in a positive way with the rest of them. I think that was important. And I will tell you this here. We were performing in Dallas, Texas. We had there was an arena that we had went to that had been rented out, and this arena had it was a crade event, community to remove all images of divine, and Imam Muhammad was on the stage, and when Birds of a Feather came on, man, I could see him patting his foot. I mean, he wasn't just patting his foot; he was stomping his foot. It was just the rhythm of it. You know, it was like this here, and the words and everything, and he just got into the spirit of it. And, that was a really good memory. But I just think it's important for the community to know that, you know, Imam W.D. Muhammad did appreciate it, and I appreciated the fact that seeing that, and that it was still very inspirational to me. I wanted to, you know, kind of move on to another part of hip-hop, though, because we talked about the first part of Sugar Hill Gang. Oh, let me just say this here. If you have a question or you have a comment, please press 1 on your phone, and we'll be happy to bring you into the queue, Sister Martha. So if anybody has a comment, just let us know, and we'll stop and bring them into the queue, okay?
Okay.
Yes.
There is another part, and we talked about the beginning, Sugar Hill Gang, and we talked about Run DMC and this change that happened with, you know, just rhythm, you know, just dealing with the drum. But then it changed back with Dr. Dre and Snoop Dogg with The Chronic, and they started putting tones back in the music. This whole idea of East Coast and West Coast, Bell, you know, can you say something to that? What was, you know, because at one time it was just, the East Coast was just, you know, the dominant factor, and then it got to the West Coast. You know, what was the transitions as far as that was concerned?
So, of course, hip-hop starts in the Bronx, Cedric Avenue, at a party with DJ Kool Herc, recognizing that the break beats are the sections of the song that the dancers wind up getting excited about. Once that happens, the idea of it begins to spread, right? And so it spreads all across the country. As you begin to think about people moving from New York, people having family in different places across the country, right, and the sharing of the idea of hip-hop, the music of hip-hop, at that time, obviously, it's cassette tapes, right? It's cassette tapes. I have a cassette tape that I saved, that I recorded the, you know, WBLS or 98.7 Kiss FM, you know, and I have this tape, and I go to my cousins in Pennsylvania, and I play this tape for them. And they've never heard this stuff. And you're like, yo, what is that? But think about that happening when you go to California or someone goes to North Carolina, right? So the music spreads. The idea of hip-hop spreads. And so people gravitate towards it and begin the process of creating in their own way. And so that influence made it out to California. And it was before Dr. Dre and them, right? Right? It's before Dr. Dre and them where you have MCs like Ice-T. Right, who everybody knows or more so would know today from, is it Law and Order that he plays a police officer on? So
that's right.
Ice-T, however, was one of the influential MCs in Los Angeles who had taken his experience with hip hop and began to craft his own voice. And that voice became one of the voices that inspires California MCs, right? And so they began to start to talk about their existence on the West Coast. Their existence on the West Coast is different from our existence on the East Coast. We had gangs, but we didn't have generational conflict that bled out so intensely into not only the streets and the you know, schools, but then were passed down from family member to family member, generation to generation, in such a violent way. We didn't know about that. We weren't privy to that information. And so Ice-T and then the group of MCs that come along with him in that space begin to talk about realities in California the same way Nelly Mal does here with The Message, right, in the early 80s when he talks about broken glass everywhere. So now people are talking about the realities of life in the ghetto. Rather than let's party and talk about how much fun we're going to have, they start talking about what's happening. And so the East Coast is moving in that direction. And I want to say something about how the East Coast influences the West Coast. The influence, what you're talking about with Dr. Dre and the Chronic, yeah, that was happening, but that happened previously here on the West Coast, I mean on the East Coast, right? With groups like, for instance, EPMD. If you go back and listen to EPMD, Eric and Parrish Making Dollars, here on the East Coast, right, EPMD put out six studio albums. If you listen to their music, the music they were creating, they were doing that way before Dr. Dre and them. Way before. Go back and listen to You a Customer. It's my thing. They was already doing that. Dr. Dre and them guys, Dre being a DJ, he also had access to records that he was doing the same thing. Listening to this music that we all grew up with, you know, from the 60s, 70s, and 80s, and you saw the sample, and he was doing the same thing. So I think that East Coast did that. You know, pop, they started using more tones and melodies and music. I mean, listen to Special Ed, right? I got it made, right? When you're listening to a Tribe Called Quest, or you're listening to, like, there were so many artists, even Coogee Rap, when you listen to, you know, Road to the Riches or On the Streets in New York, he had the horns in there being played. You know, they sample horns and guitars. Like, we were already doing that. And the East Coast,
so this was
I mean, the
after,
West Coast,
this was after
the West
Run
Coast
DMC.
Started doing it. Yes. What? EPMD is okay. EPMD, I guess, is maybe 86, 87, 88. They're doing the funk music that you hear come out of L.A., and you're like, woo. The thing is, it wasn't clean. L.A.'s joints, when they did their sampling, when they put their music together, and that's why Dre is one of the greatest producers ever, is because of the way he produced the music. You know what I mean? His clarity, the way he was bringing in different instruments. And that then speaks to how producers then become so multi-talented in the way in which they start developing music over time. Timbaland, Pharrell, Scott Storch, Nas Professor from Main Source, Premier from Gangstar, when you know Q-Tip from A Tribe Called Quest. Think about De La Soul, or think about Kwame. You remember Kwame?
I think so.
There was a whole period of time where, like, there was so much differentiation between the music over here that was being produced on the East Coast out of New York. It was so amazing that it inspired other people, other places to take those chances and those risks. And that's why you today have so many artists from different parts of the country, all over the world, who have these sounds because they were inspired to chase sounds based on what happened over here in the East Coast.
Let me ask you about this group, because this was a group that really got attention. And I think because of the name, you know, everybody's, you know, doing names like some of the names that you've mentioned, but nobody had a name like N.W.A., Niggas with Attitudes.
No, not at all.
You think that was a promotional thing or what?
Not only that, man, but it was super inspiring. It was inspiring to us, right? It was inspiring to us because it was like, again, the conversations, the way we talked, the way we were, away from people, right? You know, we couldn't be Niggas with Attitudes on 42nd Street, right? If you nigga with attitude on 42nd Street, there's a problem. You might get killed. You might get arrested, right? But for us to recognize that, and that was what made it powerful, right? Was that these guys from LA, who we had no clue of what was going on with them, and I want to also throw in a movie right quick, which Ice-T was a part of, which also helped us understand it. It was called Colors. It was a movie called Colors, and it starred Sean Penn, and I forget the gentleman's name, but he's a very famous actor as well. The two of them played police officers in L.A., and that was the first time that we got an opportunity, that I had an opportunity to see what Los Angeles was like, and we understood all of a sudden why these brothers felt the way that they felt, because the things that were happening in L.A. were not happening in New York and could not happen in New York, right? And so it was crazy to see what was happening with them, with the gangs, with the police brutality, with the laws, with the different ways that they were living. But Ice-T also did the song, the main song off the soundtrack, and it was called Colors. And that was... the first line off the song was, "I am a walking nightmare," right? So again, that connection with LA, man, that Niggas with Attitudes, that to drive down the street, and I remember this being with my brother, brother Kareem's other son, Tawheed. I remember being in the car with him and pulling up to lights where there were police and blasting "Fuck the Police," excuse my verbiage, but blasting that song, and they couldn't do anything because it's just a song. You know what I'm saying?
Right.
And
that was a song from LA. That was from LA.
It was NWA. It was NWA. NWA's real song that kind of pushed them out into the atmosphere. And again, we felt that, right? Like, people felt that in our inner-city environments, but never really were able to say it and feel comfortable, because you knew if you said it, they might find you and hurt you, right? You knew that. If you said to the police, "F the Police," that they could grab you, take you in their car, take you to some hidden place, beat the hell out of you, and then drop you back off, and there was nothing you could do about that, right? And they made that clear in the movie Colors as well. You know, in the movie, they do that. They take people and beat them to, you know, into their death. And there's nothing that can be done about
right.
it because they run the table.
Just
so that was
to give you some update.
Was definitely incredible.
Just to give you some update, Robert Duvall was also in the
Robert
movie.
Duvall.
I think that was one of the guys. Yeah, that you were talking about. And also, what was interesting that you know some of the people that was in the movie, Don Cheadle was in that movie. Glenn Plummer was in that movie. You know, but the main two was Robert Duvall and Sean Penn. Those were the and you say that was Ice-T in the movie?
Ice-T was not in the movie, which is interesting, right? Ice-T
okay.
was the person who did the song, the main song with the soundtrack called Colors. But again,
right.
look at how Ice-T evolved. And that is the story of hip-hop, right? The story of hip-hop is this art form that comes from the street, that came from the people, that rejuvenated people's ideas around taking control, having a voice. They were the voiceless. And this is what Quick Kids' experience is about. It's about bringing voice to the voiceless. And that is what hip-hop did and does. It brings voice to the voiceless. But it has become a business as well. It's not just that anymore, where it gives voice to the voiceless. That's what happens in the neighborhoods. That's what happens in the communities. But what happens in the industry is completely about how you make money and benefit. Quickly, I was listening to something where
I just wanted to say this real quick. Yeah.
Jimmy Iovine says to Pharrell, "Do you like house music?" And Pharrell says, "Yes. I think it's a great genre." And then Jimmy Iovine says, "No, I don't mean that. I mean music that gets you a house." Right? The idea
Ooh.
Of what we do is about the love and passion of the music and what it is. But when the industry grabs it, it's about making money and how you can make more of it for yourself. So just wanted to say that. Go ahead, Pop. Sorry.
Yeah, I'm good. That was a very well said because it's a good transition into, the part of it, which goes to, you know, Islam says music is haram, and many times it's because of the message, but it's the industry that changed the message. And I say that because there were a lot of positive groups that were coming out of New York. I remember, some group where they would say, and the key,
I've met Curtis Blow, I met Love Bug Starsky, I met I've met all these people, Melly Mel, I've met these people in this neighborhood, and
right.
It's always amazing, man, when we think about it. It comes from here, but, yeah, without a shadow of a doubt.
Right. So there was X-Clan, and there were, you know, some other groups that were coming up at the time that were also, trying to be positive. It's the industry, Tribe Called Quest. But the industry kind of knocked that down. Boogie Down Frog, what's his name?
KRS-One.
The brother from KRS-One.
The teacher.
Yeah, these guys was, was being positive, but then it seems that the industry, not even Eric B. and Rakim would follow the leader. You know, these were...
Know the ledge. You know what I'm saying? Powerful music. Come on.
So then how did it change from, whereas it has gotten so, I think that, we're saying is that people just basically started talking about their life and the industry started supporting that. They didn't want to hear the positive stuff. It's like, look, you know, just tell me about your life, you know, on the streets, you know, and, you know, let's just go with that.
Crafting, right? Crafting is a big part of artistry, right? You know, the time you take to create a piece of art isn't instantaneous, right? We don't go with the first draft of. And in this climate that we live in today, where reality TV, reality music is also similar, right? It doesn't take much to produce reality television, right? You just have to put the right pieces in place and allow them to do what it is that they do, right? So shows like Big Brother, shows like Survivor, shows like The Real Housewives of wherever, shows like the MTV show that they had for years, which they still do in different variations, you know, where they put a bunch of people in a house together, you know what I'm saying? And it's like, let these people live there and see what they're doing. Hip-hop has become the same.
Crafting, yeah.
It's easy mm-hmm. to produce. It doesn't require the record companies to put a large investment in. They don't need to have managers or dance choreographers or people who teach you about, you know, perfection of your vocals. None of it. They don't waste any more of that money. All they need to do is find someone who has a group of followers and has made some music that is being listened to, and then they just put money behind that, right? And it's less money. It doesn't require them to make a large investment. They can just use the system that's already in place, which is their distribution system, their marketing and their promotion teams, and that's what they do. And these young people make the money directly now because they have the resources to monetize a lot of their social media outlets. They're smarter in terms of understanding the people who are doing this, the young people. They're smart enough to understand, I don't need you. I can just do whatever I want to do, and I just need your machine at the end to push it because I'm already making money off of YouTube and off of Instagram and TikTok. And now I want to maximize that. And the ones who do it the best, who are the smartest at it, are the ones who wind up with deals with these people, and they're able to grow bigger. You know?
So it's interesting.
It's changed from crafting artists to just really backing artists who are already out there.
Assalamu alaikum.
You know, it's interesting. Walaikum assalam. Go ahead, Sister Martha.
Alhamdulillah. Praise be to God. I want to, and thank you, Cavell. You know, I was listening and I almost lost thought in what my question. Want to include Atlanta. Because I
yes,
come to know, you know, the South, as you were mentioning about the historic disenfranchisement or the abuse.
Mm-hmm.
And you know
mm-hmm.
The South, I won't say you know, but I know being in the South,
right.
and just the culture of knowing where to, as they used to say, you know what to do, when to do it, and how to do it with respect
right.
to other people. So you know to
mm-hmm.
stay on your side of the street, so to speak. But when it came to music, and I must say Florida, don't y'all hang us over using that term, hang, but Florida being the last one to say, by the time it got to Florida, a new wave had already started. But
mm-hmm.
Atlanta with Gary, what is it, Gordon,
mm-hmm.
the introduction and from R&B and on up to hip-hop, but saying that it really
mm-hmm.
had its roots there in Atlanta and some
mm.
of the individuals and groups that come through Atlanta. So can
yes,
you
sir.
Speak to that in connection to the relationship between Atlanta and the Northeast?
Atlanta has become a great hub of music, and particularly in hip-hop. And one of the things that they credit to their success is the shared love and complementing one another. They would combine rather than compete. So in New York, because the energy, and we talked about it earlier, was more, I'm better than you, my neighborhood's better than yours. In Atlanta, from what I've heard in documentaries and seen through my own experiences, and the South in general, I want to say in Houston, North Carolina, and other places in the South, Maryland, these people have been able to collaborate more, and in their collaboration, grow their network, thus having more of an impact on the hip-hop landscape. So a lot of the Atlanta artists did have some cosign or association with Northeastern in terms of New York rappers, New York, Philadelphia, and other places here. And they just took that experience that they got with those MCs, those people, which sometimes, coming back to, you know, the criminality of it, had to do with, you know, taking drugs from New York City, going down to the South. And as you go down to the South, you're now down there for a while, again, sharing this information, sharing this music, sharing these experiences. And then all of a sudden, now you get this growing music environment in Atlanta. And Atlanta, again, think about T.I., think about Future, think about artists like Pharrell, some of the other guys that have come out of there, like Outkast, right? These people have become Goody Mob. These guys are like tremendous pioneers of the Southern rap game. And again, today, it seems as though the Southern MCs, the Southern industry of rap is really in control to a large extent of, in terms of what's being put out and how music is being heard across this present landscape. They're very impactful. And it's because of collaboration, mm-hmm. not being against each
right.
other, not trying to one up the other one, but saying, yo, I got something. Yo, come on and jump on, and I'll help you get yours too. Just don't forget me. And they don't, and they continue to work together. And that's why I think they dominate at the level that they're dominating right now.
Thank you so, so very, very much. And as we have young, let's say new babies are being born, we know that, and I want to know, I know my own thinking, but I want to know how individuals are thinking on pairing. I don't know if you can say a better, I'm speaking of the language now, you know, the words, but I see an evolution mm-hmm. occurring where some are being conscientious about the words now.
Mm-hmm.
And now, if I mention Public Enemy, I don't know if you mentioned that. And you, I think you were saying about the police. Was that the one? Were they the group?
It was NWA. But Public Enemy and it's Public Enemy is incredible. I love Public Enemy.
Okay, okay.
Yeah, they were political.
Yes, that's what it was.
Very political.
Yes, yeah. And it ends.
Yeah, they did political statements.
It took a care of a lot of, it spoke to a lot of the issues, the civil issues that was on people's heart, as you mentioned about, you know, the government and people being disenfranchised again. And right now, it's like a repeat of that cycle. So the young people, and I'm glad that you're with the students as well, giving that input. How do you see yourself collaborating with ones in the South? I mean, I don't know, before any, you know, an eruption occurs, have some kind of influence with those that are working in the arts.
I would appreciate if you hold that question, because I got for the quick hitters, because that's a good question to bring into the quick hitters experience. We only got a minute left, and I want to take this other telephone call, you know, and give him an opportunity to say something. before we transition into the Quick Hitters experience, and then you can answer that question in that segment. Okay, Cavell?
Beautiful. We actually are going to be talking about that. So great segue, Sister Martha. Appreciate
okay.
that.
Okay, so this here is 917-856. So Jamal Dean Bilal, assalamu alaikum. Your microphone is open.
Walaikum assalam. Good afternoon. Good morning, everyone, including Sister Martha. Microphone check.
My great brother.
I'm woke this morning, brother William. I'm up. So I want to just say very quickly before you move to the next segment, this is a great historical program so far. I'm just enjoying it, and I'm sure the listeners are learning a lot. I want to ask this question regarding crossover effect of hip-hop to start with some of the early Caucasian rappers like the Beastie Boys on up to my man Mathis, Eminem, and also the universality now of hip-hop. So I would appreciate, and I'm sure our listeners would want to hear some in that regard as well. And also, the quick hitter theme intro from before, I hope you don't change it. I like that intro, brother, but alhamdulillah, do what you got to do. Thank you very much.
Don't worry, brother. You're going to hear that again. We still got it in there. That's for sure.
Thank you, brother. Thank you, brother.
I want to say something real quick before we transition. Brother Jamal, let me tell you something. You are truly my brother. I appreciate you so much, and I'm glad that, you know, we get this moment to be on the air for me to tell you thank you, right, for your efforts, for your reaching out. You are an incredible individual, man, and you will always be in my heart, sir. That is for sure.
Thank you, sir. Thank you. May Allah bless us all. Thank you, sir.
Yes, sir. Ah, we ready?
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, let's do it.
You know, he had that question about the universal, but I'm ready.
Well, don't worry. We're going to talk about that. That's
yeah, you're
going to
answer it. You answer it in the next segment, or
there's
you
no question.
You want to answer it down and then go.
Nah, go ahead, and then we'll talk about it because it's about to lead right into what we're talking about today.
Okay, here we go.
Wait, he made a blame of inspiration over
me.
We had up to get us ready for
radiance. Resilient.
God's got a bigger plan.
Dream, work, team, not a verse. Keep watching, keep watching. 30 daily, you feel me? Quickest on the cloud. Who we linking up with now?
On the ground, folks, and guess who we play? We have to take it. We turn out the place like the man I keep forgetting. DJ, 58, 50 Kendrick, top five that are alive. Well, you know, I get started. I'm sorry. It's 12.
Yeah, we know.
And it's time to get it popping. You know what I mean? Hey, thank you for playing that one. Next time, let's play It's Our Turn. But I appreciate you. Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to the show. I am your host, Mr. Cavell, and I was here already with Papa Dap, and I want to thank you for that wonderful conversation, man. It was an incredible moment, man. You know, voices to the voiceless. That's what we do here, you know.
No
our program is Create Hip Hop Based Projects for Youth through partnerships with schools and community-based organizations. So if you have anybody who you would like to connect us with or you would like to get involved yourself to learn more, please visit www.quickhitters.org or call us at 405-807-6226. To join the experience today. We have a great show for you as always, which includes our Unapologetically Our Music segment, our quick hit segment, quick quotes, you dance, and of course, Take It Personal. And all of these are an opportunity for you to jump in and get involved. So if you would like to, please make sure that you hit one on that on your phone so that you can jump in and join the experience. But Pop, let's get busy. And let me answer this question first before we get into conversation. Brother Jamal, I think that hip-hop is definitely a universal piece at this point, and the contribution of white people, not only in the background but in the forefront, has become one of those things where we know that there is always an inclusion of the majority culture. The majority of that culture is white. And so the impact that they've had in terms of the early existence in the culture is massive. I mean, Def Jam starts because Rick Rubin, a white student at NYU, meets Russell Simmons, and the two of them recognize what's happening in the culture underground and begin to develop a business plan to go forward to create an area for themselves to market this and push this music out to the world. And so when you mention the Beastie Boys were signed to Def Jam, right? Because, again, the influences from the very beginning, right? When you talk about moving up further into an MC, and particularly Eminem, we skip over MCs like Vanilla Ice. We skip over Everlast. We skip over Third Base. All of these were white rappers who were involved in the culture and had some success in the culture. As a matter of fact, Third Base is one of my favorite groups. They have some really incredible music during the 80s, man. That was MC Search and I believe Pete. I think it was Pete something. Now, he wasn't Pete Rock. Pete Rock is the black producer, but Pete something, I forget right off the top of the head. But once again, I think
right.
those people created a lane where there could be an Eminem. Eminem just happens to be, somebody said this the other day, the black hockey player, right? Someone who
right.
is so good at this thing, but is the absolute furthest thing from what you think it should be and what it should look like. And he,
right,
having the opportunity to watch all of the failures of the other white MCs and successes of the white MCs, opened up a whole new can of worms for everybody once he hit the stage. And without a question, people debate this and talk about it, but from my perspective, as an MC who has seen this all throughout, has become one of the top MCs ever to touch a microphone. Right, and that I just wanted to finish that across world, there are MCs who are developing now, right? And so it can no longer just be we dominate, even though we will, right, for years to come, we will still dominate. But there are going to be MCs like MC Abdul, who we played a couple of weeks ago, right, who's from Palestine, right? You know, this kid is coming. You know what I'm saying? There are MCs coming from London. There are MCs that are coming from China who spit in Chinese, but they are inevitably going to start getting more into using English. And then, so the evolution, the universality of our culture is still very small, only 50 years, but the impact is so major that there is no doubt there will be so many different things for us to listen to in different ways, man, that come from the foundation.
I think it's important to mention Cypress Hill, because I think that's what Cypress Hill did, that Cypress Hill actually it seemed that the way that they marketed their song "Jump Around" was to the white audience.
Well, that wasn't Cypress Hill, right? That was a different group. "Jump Around" was done by some white guys from Boston. They were from Boston, and I forget what their names were right now, man. But the MC, the one House of Pain. The MC was Everlast. Everlast was the MC. Great music. They had a great, but again, they only were there for a moment because you have to keep connecting, and they couldn't keep it connecting. But they had a few joints that were dope. You can't be mad at it. You know what I mean?
Yeah, you can't be mad at it. It was dope. And if you go on the radio, if you go on the internet today and you plug in white rap artists, man, you will find so many white rap artists. And some of them are really good. I just watched one who was, I forget his name, but millions of views. Millions of views. But he's speaking from the perspective, he was speaking from this perspective of love America. Come for America. He had like a uniform and all of that. But he had tattoos on his face with the brain. He still looked completely like a rapper. But he just was speaking from a different space. You know what I'm saying? And this is what we're going to have, man. And, you know, we have to embrace the, we have to embrace what we have put out there. It's a form of flattery. It's a form of flattery.
Right.
You know, and we should take it that way. You know what I mean? But that's where we at, you know. And I appreciate the brother, man. Again, man, I appreciate you, Brother Jamal, so much, man, for your continuous support of the show and your input on, you know, what's being said and including and being interactive. It's tremendous, man, and we always appreciate you and the things that are going on, as well as the entire community of New Day Community Radio and American Muslim 360.
I mean, no doubt, yeah. So what are we talking about today?
Let's start up a conversation. You know what I mean? We need to play our intro. Let's do it.
Okay, but I thought that was the intro.
Well, I guess
what's the intro
you
playing?
You ain't play my other intro. You ain't play my other intro, but I don't mind because you already know.
I just want you to know that I didn't find the information that you sent this morning. I didn't find it at all. So we're going to have to ad-lib this whole thing, man.
You know, this is the way it is, man. I appreciate it, and this is how you get better at what we do, right? You have to make some things work when they don't work. But that's what makes everything fly in the end, and we're going to keep on moving. We have a conversation, and this is specifically talking to what Sister Martha had brought up and put on the table, is, are our families ready for the future ahead? And we're speaking in this term financially. So are our families financially ready for the future ahead? And some of the challenges on the table that we'll talk about a little bit later in Take It Personal are lack of access to home ownership, right? While the U.S. home ownership rate increased 65% in 2021, the rate of Black Americans lags behind significantly at 44%, right? And over the last 10 years, that number has only increased by 0.4% over the last 10 years, 29% points less than white Americans, who have a 72.7% chance of home ownership. And this represents the largest Black and white home ownership gap in a decade. Black Americans are more likely to be underbanked in each of the nation's 50 largest metros, cities. Black home buyers are more likely to be denied a purchase mortgage than the overall population of home buyers, at an average of 14.4% denied mortgages and 5.3% points higher than the average denial rate across the country for the whole population, which is 9.4. So once again, we are behind and in this resource of being banked and moving into an opportunity that can help us generate a prosperous future. Black Americans also face lower median credit scores. Rates of subprime credit scores in majority Black, Hispanic, and Native American communities are at least 1.5 times higher than in majority white communities, according to a 2002 report. The institutes define subprime as poor or fair credit scores that fall below 670. Again, are we really preparing our families for a financial future that is going to have them sustained? Please, if you have a question, if you'd like to make a comment, please hit that one on your phone and jump on in with us right away so we can talk a little bit about this. Once again, this is Unapologetically Our Music Show. Pop, what do you say?
Well, what I say is that this is by design. I mean, there's no question about that. The numbers that you have quoted is by design. But I know from my own experience, being denied a mortgage, having, you know, the down payment to live in a particular neighborhood that I wanted to live in, and it was like I knew that I would have the down payment, which was like 20%. So I had the down payment for the house, and also you know that I knew that I could take care of the mortgage. And so I asked for something like $350,000, and you know he's like, well, we'll get. They said, well, we'll give you $250,000, but that's not what I needed. I didn't need $250,000 because $250,000 I couldn't live in the neighborhood that I wanted to live in. So they were basically saying, yeah, we'll give you a loan, but you got to go live in this neighborhood. You got to go live in this neighborhood over here. We don't want you living in the other neighborhood. And then what happened was I saw that there started to be an increase, not only as far as the value of the homes are concerned. As a matter of fact, you know, they did that Bernie Madoff thing at one time, and they made home ownership available, whereas you could have a 2% down payment, and they let you get in the neighborhood, and then they automatically raised it. They wound up raising the mortgage rates, and then people got caught out there, and they lost the home, they lost the down payment, they lost everything, because you know that's just the way that the interest market works. They make it whatever the hell they want to make it. Then what happened was they did a thing as far as rental properties was concerned, you know, whereas they astronomically raised the rental properties, you know, double, you know, so they put you know, especially the African American in a situation where, you know, we don't want you to, we want you to stay right where you are and give us more money. And give us more money.
You're correct, and this is definitely a practice, and that practice is called redlining, right? That practice is a discrimination during the home buying process because of someone's race or ethnicity, and that has denied the black community equal access to credit and home buying power over many years, which is really weird because, again, after the war, after the Second World War, that was a big part of what helped many of those individuals who fought for this country, believed in the principles of this country, and wanted to show how dedicated they were to this country. They benefited by being able to take those monies and go out and buy homes. And then this redlining process
became the way in which you're talking about 1945, 1950.
Right. We're talking about, and the practice, again, when we're talking about the future we're leaving for our children, right, have we really moved a distance from what hindered us previously in other generations? Has that happened? And the fact that I can go back and talk about 1945 and the practice is still being used in 2023 only says to us how far have we gone and have we prepared our children for the future, especially financially. Have we talked to them about redlining? Have we talked to them about that discrimination? Because those practices continue to exist and racism inserted into property deeds, which forbade black Americans from home owning, from owning houses in certain neighborhoods up until 1948 with a Supreme Court case, Shelley versus Kramer, and the passage of the Fair Housing Act of 1968, right? We're talking about there needed to be laws put in place in order for people of color to receive fair and equitable opportunities to own homes in America. And that goes back to the 1948 case with Shelley versus Kramer, Fair Housing Act of 1968, and yet and still in 2023, it is difficult for someone of color to get a loan to buy a home.
Yeah, but what's another part of that one of the things that we have to look at as far as that's concerned is the way that you know, our community operates as opposed to the way that other communities operate. We operate many a times as individuals. I want to own a home. It's not like we want to own a home. It's like I want to own a home. So when you talk about, when I'm talking about I'm talking about one family wants to own a home. And so a man and a woman. So if a man and woman is just working on a job, then, you know, they want to own a home. It's like it's one family trying to do it, as opposed to other communities. And I think that this is where the difference comes in. You know, you start talking about other communities that come here from overseas. You start talking about the Mexican communities. And people coming from South America, I think that they have a more, they work together more, whereas they talk about four or five families putting money together to get things. I think that that has something to do with it.
As-salamu alaykum.
I think it also.
We do have a caller.
Yes. Alaykum as-salam.
Yes, we do have a caller. If you're ready, raise their hand. 314. Okay, 314-677. Assalamu alaikum.
Yeah, good morning. How are you? You know, I've listened
Wonderful.
To the conversation, and a lot of things is involved in what you're pointing out. And as far as, you know, Nigerians have no problem to the extent when they come to the United States, or even those first, second, and third generations. They have the highest education attainment of any ethnic group, and they have a highest household income, and their skin is black as Wesley Snipes. I think what we see in traditional American blacks that's so prevalent is the education of the young people, and it's not their fault. It's parents, family, and society. They're not being educated accordingly. And when you look at the data that measure the educational attainment, it's still lacking in so many ways. That has to change because these other ethnic groups are just running past now. Even the Alaskan Eskimos. So that there has to change. The family had to be rebuilt. You can't, you know, a child that comes under, is raised under a structured, functional family are prone to be more successful in society than the one that's not. And then you got these crime-ridden areas for whatever the reading. You know, redlining tells you where not to move, where not to go to school. It tells the insurance company for your automobile that the rates here is going to have to be higher because there's so much more incidence of automobile accidents, car thefts, so on, so on, so on. So we have to reckon with this. And, you know, in these professional high-demanding fields, and by the way, there are a lot of young blacks that's doing tremendous things, but they never get any mention. And I think it's probably even better that they're not. But there's so many that's not. But, you know, when you look into these engineering fields, these STEM fields, we're not there at the numbers that represent the percentages in the population. Now, are there some? There's a lot. Well, as I said before, they're not being mentioned. So what's your comment on what I just said?
Of course, because when you call in, brother, you know, like, you know, we're asking you. We're asking you to respect us.
And he is hung. He is disconnected.
Yeah, he disconnected. Yeah, he disconnected. And he disconnected because, I mean, he always comes. He was on Kwasi Mensah's show all the time, so I know him. Because you know, Sister Martha, that we have done programs, and people have said, yeah, well, how are you, or hello. They've done that. And we don't hold it against them. No, because we want to take calls from everybody. But this person was being disrespectful. That's all I'm pointing out. I'm sorry, but I'm sorry that I had to take the time to do that, but I had to do it.
No, right now they're listeners, but no one has their hand raised right now.
Very good.
Thank you.
Okay.
Which is truly official is that people are able to gather with other family members or other resources available to them to get the money to be able to move into the home ownership space.
Yeah, we was on 125th Street. I went to pick up Sister Martha on 125th Street, and there was a guy out there with a fruit stand. He's out there with the fruit stand. And so I said, Sister Martha, would you like a piece of fruit, And she said, oh, yeah, I'd like a papaya. The guy was selling papayas $2 for $5. Now, I know that, you could get, I've seen guys out there in the street that's selling papayas $1 a piece. But he was selling his $2 for $5. So, again, people come into the African-American community and, pump up the prices or everything, and then we as the people support it. And what we really have to do in situations like that. Yeah, go ahead, Cavell.
No, I agree with you, and that also has a lot to do with the fact that, you're generating money in order to support yourself and make a profit.
Yes, support yourself.
Right, and again, this is economics 101 in the black community, right? We have a reluctancy to support one another, but we have no problem supporting when we go into a white neighborhood. So if we go to an environment like we're on 44th Street and we go into a store and they tell us that, we have to pay $2.90 for this soda, but we in our own neighborhood pay $1.50. We still pay the $2.90 instead of just walking out because it's what we want, right? And so I think some of it has to do with the desire to have what you want as an individual, right? You just want this thing, so you'll spend this money.
True.
But then there are people who say,
true,
I won't do that because I know that I can go and get that somewhere else cheaper, and that is intelligent finance, to being financially responsible. That, again, is where, we are in this conversation, which is really talking about whether or not we're preparing our young people and our families for the future financially. It doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to give you a house or I'm going to leave you $500,000, but I should be able to at least leave you some strategies that teach you how to maintain money, gain money, keep money. And one of those things, just like you mentioned, is, if someone is trying to sell you something that you clearly know doesn't cost that, then okay, I'm fine. No, I won't be with any papaya right now. I'll walk up the block or go a couple of blocks and I'll get the dollar papaya. But that's
I don't know if I told you about the situation I had with one of the sports, the exercise clubs, but I found, and this is the other thing as far as technology has given people that we do business with the opportunity to just take money out our accounts, just take the money, and if there's a dissatisfaction as far as service is concerned. It's like, you can't find a way to get out of it. I had a situation with one of these health clubs, And, you know, it was supposed to be a monthly fee, and I was in no problem with that. But then, you know, they wound up charging me an annual fee. And when I found out about it, I immediately went to the club and told them, you know, what is this for? And they tell me, oh, you know, it's the annual fee. I said, well, I didn't know about that at the beginning. You know, I don't want to pay it. Well, you know, like, it's too late. You got to do it. You know, you signed. You already signed, so, you know, I said, but I don't agree with this, you know, I don't want to do business with you anymore. So, you know, like, I don't appreciate it, you know, so I would like my money back. You know, nope, you can't get your money back on it. And so I said, okay, but this is, of course, they had the opportunity to automatically take the money out of my account. And then they tell me, you can't get it back.
Another thing, too, is reading these contracts, right? It's so simple to actually get into a contract with someone financially when you want it right now. Like, I want this right now, so I'm willing to jump into the contract without reading it.
Yes.
Right, without sitting down and reading it. I mean, on the internet, we do this all day, right? There is a pop-up that comes up, and it says, you know, in order for you to view this site, you need to accept cookies. And then they slide a whole bunch of things underneath it. And then you just click, okay.
Right.
Not knowing that in that whole thing, they're saying, you know, we're going to share your information with a third party, who's going to pay us for that information. And you by accepting are saying that you're okay with me giving your information to somebody else. Again, it doesn't promote. And this is where I think thinking about this problem of underbanking and also financially preparing our young people and preparing our families for the future, we have to start thinking about it in a different way. Even in the banking, they're saying from a policy level, integrating financial literacy as a mandatory curriculum in K-12 would help bridge the gap between wealth and race, right? And the reason why is because teaching financial responsibility from day one, right, and not only in the home, but teaching it inside of a school building would impact incredibly the ability for our families in our neighborhoods, black and brown, to understand how to handle money. What is discipline with money? The same way someone will discipline their diet so that they don't eat sugar, or I'm allergic to, you know, nuts or shellfish, and you all of a sudden discipline yourself to not eat at this place or go to that store, is the same thing that we have to think about financially when we think about the way we deal with these financial institutions and, again, finances in general. But that learning starts at a very young age, similarly to the way in which we learned hip-hop from you. We started at a young age. We understood that's why we became good at it, because we understood. And I think that's the same reason why someone who's a doctor teaches their children to be doctors. Of course, their children are more amenable to a situation where it has to do with medicine, because they grew up around,
well, you know,
same with mechanics. If you grew up around mechanics, you know, you're going to be lively to take on some of that information and be able to operate in that world. Financially, I feel like it would be and should be the same
thing. You're right, 100%. And I don't think the schools have an interest in doing it, because if they did that, then, you know, the children would become financially literate, and in the process of financially literate, they would make adjustments and changes that would affect the economy. And so I don't think that's why that they wouldn't want that to happen. But, you know, just because if the schools won't teach it doesn't mean that it can't be taught in community centers. It can't be taught in mosques and churches and other community organizations to teach, to have classes of financial literacy, you know, in particular for children in our community.
It's a big push for it to happen, and I think, again, what has happened
in the school
uniquely. What has happened unique? Listen, I work for, if you guys don't know, I have my own business, which is the Quick Hitters Experience, in which we create hip hop based projects around the five components of hip-hop, DJ and MC and graffiti, knowledge, and b-boying. But I work for the Department of Education in the central office where business is being done regarding the schools and the students. And the bottom line is families have got to take control of the way in which they're educating their children. The school is a supplement. The school is an addition to what it is that needs to be taught. We as the family have got to grab and get involved in educating our students. It is clear that many people in our neighborhoods do not have the educational backgrounds to or work within the educational system to be able to recognize the deficiencies that are inherent in the school system. But I see it every day. And I tell, and I'm saying on this program, and I tell people who I talk to, the emphasis is on you being the advocate for how your child is educated. Expecting the school to do it is not feasible. And it comes back to something very simple. How much money, as we're talking about financial readiness, how much money is being taken out of taxes in your community? Every community school, in terms of public schools, are being funded by the amount of taxes collected in that area. And so when you talk about a low-income environment, that means a low-income school. And the reason why is because of the taxes and the connection between how much money is being made, the amount of financial stability of the people in that community, that's going to affect how many great teachers you have, how many great programs.
So does the community board situation work? Does this community board situation work for parents to be involved in the community board?
It does. As let's forget the community board, yes. But let's get smaller. Be a part of your parent association in the school. Right? The parent coordinator is there to foster conversation between the parents and the school. That's the parent coordinator's job in the school. And I have been in schools for many years. Do you know that it is rare to have parents show up to a parent association meeting in the neighborhood? I mean, rare. Maybe you got six people. You have to actually form a parent association, right? You need a president, a vice president, a secretary, a treasurer. Sometimes the treasurer is the vice president because you don't have enough people willing to commit to being a part of the parent association that actually impacts what happens for the students inside of the school. Their own children.
Right, but,
so
but, does, but
the,
it could have something
board,
to do with the whole idea of work, right? You know, of their time, them not having time or the time that the board is meeting, can it have something to do with that?
Man,
and if it does, I mean,
are
you saying that the parents still have to find a way?
You got to find a way. You want your kids to be incredible.
Right.
Listen, I show up at my kids' stuff all the time. And if I have an issue, I call the school. If something happens with my kid, I'm the first one there. I'm not playing no games. I'm my kid's lawyer. I'm your greatest advocate. If you get in trouble, I need to know first. Tell me everything. I learned that from you, Pop. Something happens, tell me first. I'll show up. Why? Because they need to see I care. Not just that, you know, I send you every day. Not just that you look good every day. Not that you did your homework every day. But what is it that I need from the school so that my child can be the greatest possible product in terms of what we expect? I got to get involved. And yes, to comment on what you were saying, yes, work is there. Yes, being tired. Yes, I got to go home and cook and clean. Yeah, I may have two or three other kids. But what do you want for your child? You have to go and be involved in the environment to get what you want for your child. And then if they're denying you, then you can make the steps further up in the system to push the education, DOE, the school, to do what it is you need done. But that takes voices. That takes power. And that is one thing that in another community, in white communities, communities like Chinese communities, communities where what we're talking about is they have solidarity, they go in and they make noise. And because they make noise, they get the things they want. We have to be the same way. Make the noise, push for what we want, and we will get it. It's happening all over the country and has been, and particularly after the pandemic, been happening at a larger rate.
What about,
As-salamu alaykum.
I want to ask you another question. Walaikum as-salam, go ahead.
Okay, sorry about my background here. Listen, my question is, as you were speaking, Kavel, about the parents and their involvement, I've come to know that home ownership, this is why the thrust for home ownership is so important, because the taxes,
yes,
as you spoke of, is divvied from the taxes that you pay on your home. It's divvied,
yes,
within the community. And so if there's no home ownership, it comes back around to that cycle. And, but I know the CRA was developed for Community Reinvestment Act, but and then the other areas from the government, Fannie Mae and those who make it more affordable to become homeowners. I think a further conversation is going to need to be had where the music industry can, educate as well from that angle. I know we have it from other, you know, like the ones speaking about the civic government right now, the civic,
mm-hmm,
of,
yes,
government, and how, and the young man is really, really speaking to that needed information. So how,
mm-hmm,
what do you think about that, about home ownership and getting the information that way, how to get connected?
To me, as you speak on it, you are absolutely correct, right? And this is the reason why I wanted to bring up this conversation today. Because, again, the concern I see working within the Department of Education, and not just in the area I work in. I work with all schools, different schools, all throughout the city for my position. What we're seeing is the fact that in communities that are considered affluent, even in the city, that people have more input. That those people, because of the money they pay for the apartment or condo or for their, you know, for their residency that they own down in a particular area in a different district, like maybe District 2 in New York City or District 5 in New York City, right? I don't think 5, but like 2, 1. There's certain districts where their impact in terms of what they want to happen in their schools, it happens. And they retain teachers for a longer period of time. The teachers don't come in as they do in our communities, stay for a couple of years because they're trying to get their loans paid off, and then say that they work with these inner city school kids, and then they leave. The kids have a connection to them, feel really connected with them, and then they get out of here and go somewhere else for their own success, their own purposes. This is because we can't pay them, right? They would stay because they love the kids. Teachers usually teach because they love teaching kids, right? And so if you could pay them a fair wage that would allow for them to stay, they would stay. But because here in the city, in our communities, the amount of the budget is not there to pay them, they leave and go to a more affluent area where they know they're going to make, where they know they're going to have the resources, like the technology that's going to be available. They're going to have access to good curriculums. They're also going to have a level of support from parents where they can impact, where they can just teach, not always have to be about behavioral issues or social issues that are coming down the pipeline. And that once again comes back to how can you get a loan to be able to purchase this condominium here in the city or this brownstone here on Shriver's Row? How can you do that if there is a system already in place to keep you from being able to do that in this particular area? It requires us having access to some of those financial institutions, not just to having the community around us develop, do a crowdfunding, which is effective as well, but also having the access to, as my father said earlier, I don't need $250,000, I need $350,000 because this is the area I want to be in. Telling me I can't be there and not giving me the opportunity to do so is, in effect, keeping us as a people in a certain cycle, and that affects education and children's opportunity to be able to handle what is coming in the future. I appreciate your question, Sister Martha.
Alhamdulillah, thank you.
I don't really lie to Bill. I mean, we got 5 minutes left in the program. Bill, what do you want to talk about?
Hey, man, listen, I'm going to talk about
this. Has been an excellent conversation, man. No doubt, man. You know, this has been excellent. An excellent conversation,
listen,
you know.
I appreciate even having the platform, Pop. So thank you and the New Day Community Radio for providing that, as well as American Muslim 360. It's definitely something that I'm passionate about, have been passionate about, and is a premise of why I created the Quick Hitters Experience. I could have taught the Quick Hitters Experience inside of a school building and been there to do that. But I really do think that it is important to have a community business, which the Quick Hitters Experience is, an entrepreneurial, independent, black-owned, for-profit business to teach and elevate our young people in a particular way through the culture of hip-hop and some of the experiences that we've had.
Yeah, you know, we have a telephone call for 779-770. As-salamu alaykum, your microphone is open.
Wa alaykum as-salam. Hashim Kamal. I learned a long time ago, they don't discriminate no more. They just up the price. They discriminate that way. And you price you right out. You can't afford it, so still discrimination. They don't do it all right no more.
Yeah.
They just raise the price. I'm not discriminating against.
It's raise the price. There you go.
I got
there you go. That's what they're doing.
I got a friend in the southern state. They were trying to buy some property from him. And every time they come, he said, I know how to do it. I give him a high price. They won't come back no more. They come back again, I'm going to raise
that's
the
right.
price again. This is the African-American
mm-hmm.
doing that. They were trying to
mm-hmm.
buy some property. I know how to do it. I keep raising the price.
The design.
Mm-hmm.
Design. The way
mm-hmm.
that the system is designed, that's what we have to... I mean, listen, we should be intelligent enough to be able to look at, you know, the way that the society is designed and see, you know, what's working and what's not working. We should be able to look at the society now. I mean, hey, you look at the society now, we should be able to do that. And then I think the question is that, okay, so that's the design. So now how do we go ahead and design what we need to do in order for us to move forward? Well, we got 2 minutes left.
So what I would say is what we're doing right now, having this conversation, being able to spread information amongst each other that is viable, and now we need to apply. We need to apply that information in our communities, in our families. We talk all the time about God, self, family, community, the world. Those are 5 principles, God, self, family, community, the world. Spiritually, we are working on ourselves and we continue to grow better. We have to continue to instill that in our young people to have a good spirit, right? Good spirit goes a long way. And work on themselves, becoming greater, disciplining yourself, understanding how you have to move through this world. And that takes talking to those who have knowledge, talking to those who have tactics and experience, and can have sometimes walk you right into a room to assist you in growing into the future. In terms of our families, we have to be more intentional about spending time with family, talking with family, being about the family and not just the family in our house all the time. So that's why we move into our communities and do that with others, our friends, those who live in our buildings and our complexes, those who we know from school, those who we have relationships with, continuing to do so. And in terms of the world, we have these reaches now that, you know, because of social media and the internet and different things that are available to us, we can communicate with each other all across the world. There are resources everywhere, and we can find them. Let's start reading those contracts. Let's start paying more attention to what's put in these laws and what's put on these pages in terms of what we need to do to advance ourselves. And our families will be more than prepared because they're willing and ready and they're moving. And particularly, again, after this pandemic, I felt and I feel the energy of our culture just being like, we got it. We going. Let's get it. Again, I think that we just need to continue to add on together, young, old, and in between, and push this machine. It's going to work. Let's do it.
Inshallah. Well, we thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters. Sister Martha, you have anything else that you'd like to say before the end of the program?
Yes. I'd like to I have to invest more time into research about the property that as heir property from years from our ancestors, and how it's being researched by a minister, but I'm going to connect with him, God willing. It's with a brother, I can't think of the brother's name here in Philadelphia, who is interviewing him on an ongoing basis. So I'll get more information as to that property is worth millions, billions, really, and is saying that we're just like held in hostage because it hasn't been incorporated by the heirs who have been left the property, but they may not be aware of it. So that is a very, very big domino kind of effect change that can happen, inshallah. So thank you. Assalamu alaikum. Enjoyed everything.
Inshallah.
Wa alaikum assalam. Thank you very much. Go ahead, Salam.
Appreciate y'all. No, no, I appreciate y'all, and I want to say thank you once again to you, Pop, for keeping this format going. Brother Kareem, we love you. You are truly an icon in this in terms of hip-hop, but just in terms of the Muslim community, I appreciate you and everything that you do and how you continue to move forward. Thank you very much, and thank you to all of the Muslims out there listening. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam, and we thank you very much for those kind comments. May Allah continue to bless us. All praises due to Allah. It is now time for the Adhan prayer, and so this is a reminder. We want to go ahead and call the Adhan to end the program. And until Monday, we'll be back on with American Muslim 360 and A New Day Community Radio, IWDM Radio. We are continuing to move forward. You know, may Allah continue to bless us. Make sure you share, you know, and tell people to call in, you know, to the program. But make sure.
All right, dear listeners, and here on American Muslim 360, we ask that you return at 5 p.m., inshallah, God willing, for Al-Islam in Focus with Deprita Abdul Hadi. And I'm hesitating because I believe we were going to have from 2 to 4 our economic think tank with Imam Wali Ayyub Bilal. We will give more information back out on that, inshallah, maybe next Saturday, the last Saturday in the month rather than the 4th. All right. Thank you, dear listeners, once again. I'm going to go out with our music, inshallah, on humanity is everybody's business.
Somewhere there's disaster, someone Thank you. Be bright shining star in the night. Guide that lost soul to the right. One day we all meet on the other side and say to one another, well done.